I'm Alex.
And I'm Matt, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Rohini Mohan, an Indian journalist who writes on politics, environment, and human rights in South Asia. She's reported for Al Jazeera, Tehelka magazine, The Caravan magazine, and The New York Times, among others, and is based in Bangalore, India. She speaks four South Asian languages, and her first book is The Seasons of Trouble, a nonfiction account of three people caught up in the ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka.
It's a really great podcast, I think, and very much building on previous discussions we've had, whether with Elliot Ackerman, the episode that you did together with him in Iraq, or our first episode with Anand Gopal talking about how he wrote his book.
I have to say, I really liked her. Really liked the idea of when she talked about laying, what was it? Was it sitting in the sea of chaos of her book and trying to find calm in the middle of it. So the listeners will hear she mapped out her whole book, and we talked with her a bit about how she did this. Put these pieces of paper all around her, and then literally placed herself in the middle of it and tried to make it all make sense. And we have some very high tech guests who are real tech savvy, and this is probably one of the more low tech approaches, but definitely worked because, you really enjoyed her book.
Yeah, exactly. And it was great to hear some of this kind of context around the writing of it, and the kind of thoughts that went into the choices she made how she figured out, the voice that she was going to employ while writing it, what kinds of considerations were kind of brought to bear on the book during the editing process.
Right.
And I think suddenly there's a lot in there, not only for people who are writing the book, which admittedly is a very small percentage of the world, but people doing kind of creative pursuits in general, people who have to write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for our listeners, as you'll hear, she's joining us actually from Bangalore on the call, and you'll definitely be able to get a. You'll be placed right in the context of what it sounds like to be in that city.
So we'll just play the podcast now. Thank you.
Thanks.
I loved your book, as I've said in various corners of the internet over the past week. And I'm really happy we could get the chance among our various time zones to talk to you. Firstly, I guess as a way of kind of setting context or introducing your work to readers who are perhaps less familiar with Sri Lanka. I was hoping you might be able to read a little bit from a story you wrote for Caravan that was published in February 2012, entitled The Defeated.
Yeah, I'll do that, yeah. It had to be inappropriate to want a bath when shells were raining from the sky. But for the fifth day in a row, it was all Siva could think of. Crouching with his wife, daughter, and six others, in a hastily dug 5-foot-deep hole in the ground that was dissolving in a non-stop downpour, he was going crazy with the thick layer of mud on his skin. It itched, and he was sure he could smell blood and shit on it. Above Siva's head, across the coconut orchard of Kombaville village in Puthukudirupu region of the Mullathiva district, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam and the Sri Lankan army were exchanging gunfire. Aircraft ejected shells into the area, which had once been home to about 50 families. Since April 2009, it had been transformed into a dizzying 2-square-kilometer maze of felled trees and underground bunkers dug and redug by the army, the Tamil Tigers, and fleeing, hiding villagers. Below the rain rivulets and the rattle of machine guns, about 3,000 people cowered underground, packed like iron rods in a truck, judging danger and safety by the ebb and rise of the sounds of battle. They were petrified, but most unbearably, they were hungry. His ears ringing, Siva looked around him in the bunker. It was mid-April, more than 6 months since they'd been on the road. They were now left with only half a sack of rice and a couple of charred, semi-rotten coconuts they had collected from the bombed orchard. There was no way to cook anything. The wood was too soaked to build a fire, and his wife, Lata, had dropped the salt packet when a bullet whizzed past her head. Siva's daughter, Dhanusia, was curling up around her mother. Only 5 years old, and she already knew to go to sleep when her stomach was rumbling. He looked at his wife's pregnant belly. Please, oh please, let the baby be all right, he thought. Siva was a doting father, the kind of man who easily wove bedtime stories starring animals that talked philosophically, stories whose endings often involved the triumph of the smart rabbit, deer, or turtle over the powerful lions and panthers. He was a dutiful son. He regularly sent money home to his aging parents, but did not think he could ever live under the same roof with them. His hair was grayer than it should have been at 39. He stood taller than 6 feet, but slumped heavily, which made his legs look disproportionately long compared to his torso. Sitting in the cramped hole in the ground, unable to venture out for days on end, he often cursed his long frame for his incessant hunger. Nearly 3 years before Siva could find himself huddled in a bunker, the Sri Lankan armed forces, led by President Mahinda Rajapaksa, launched a military offensive on the separatist Tamil Tigers in Trincomalee on the east coast. The Tigers had forcefully closed the sluice gates of the Marvel Arra waterway to cut off the water supply to 15,000 villages nearby. Negotiations to open the gates failed, and the Sri Lankan Air Force attacked the Tamil Tiger bases. At the time, this had seemed to Siva like just another fight in the 26-year-long cycle of attacks and counterattacks between the predominantly Sinhala armed forces and the Tamil Tigers. He'd gone about his life unbothered, until Tamil men and women from the east, their whole lives bundled into little plastic bags, started to pour in closer to Siva's home, to the northern part of the island. They were everywhere, and soon so was the army.
So yeah, I mean, I guess the first question we could start with. So you have this book. What were you doing? What were you doing before, or what's your kind of background? Did you start off any kind of working on journalism and these kinds of things, or
I've. The longest career I have had is as a journalist, but which is 10 years now. But I used to work for 6 months in a finance company, and I hated that. I just wanted to not sit behind a desk every day. And I thought, what can I do that will allow me to be out there somewhere and do things on my own? And that sounded like journalism. I don't come from a family that has any journalists. Everyone's a banker or, an engineer. Very middle-class family. So I had to figure stuff out by myself. And I became a journalist. I started writing features, arts and culture. And that also did not seem interesting enough. And in 2004, actually, when I was covering I was covering films in Madras in India in the south, the tsunami, the Asian tsunami hit, and everyone in the office started working on that. Every reporter was put on the field on follow-ups, on news reports, and that actually started making me realize that this was something that made me feel like I was engaging with something real, and it was absolutely terrifying. I didn't know what I was doing, but I really wanted to learn. So that's how it started. It was completely different. Every day I would be reminded of my privilege, and it reminded me of that, that I did not know a whole world was out there that I wasn't aware of. So that's kind of how I started working on news. And then, I for 10 years, I've been working mostly in India. The book that I wrote is on Sri Lanka, and I've written a couple of pieces on Sri Lanka and on Nepal. But most of the 10 years have been in Delhi, in Madras, in Bangalore, in India.
And did you Did you go into, particularly once you started working on these kind of foreign stories and on this kind of expanded kind of vision of what you were doing, were you immediately doing longer articles? At least a lot of the stuff that I was able to find online are these kind of very long pieces.
No, that's only happened in the last 4 years, maybe. I guess I had to earn those number of words in a sense. So there was, most of the stories that I did in the beginning would be, 300, 400 words. I was following what we call here current affairs. So most of it was, shorter stories, dispatches in a sense. But after that, and I also worked in TV. In TV, I did half an hour shows, which were, you go in depth into a piece, into an issue, just after maybe if there's a big breaking news, then there's a team of us who would do follow-ups, and that would be a half an hour sort of documentary. And that actually started me thinking about how much more I could say if I wrote it down. And I started writing longer pieces. So maybe at the time, narrative journalism was not something that was... people thought that most people didn't want to read it. So, 1,000, 2,000 words was the longest one wrote. And since then, I think that idea that people will not read a long piece has changed to people will read it if it's written interestingly or if the subject is interesting, if it deserves a long story. So that's how I started. In Sri Lanka and Nepal, I've not done very much, but Sri Lanka's long pieces were actually all I was going to do. But as I reported more and didn't find enough space to say everything that I had and not actually know what I wanted to say until I put words down on, on a document, I thought that maybe a book would be the way to go about it. And that was the first time I was doing something like that. So it took me a while to even tell myself that I'm writing a book.
Was there one experience in particular that you witnessed or were a part of and that made you think, wow, I think I have a book here? Or was it the sense of over a decade of covering conflicts or events partially related to the Sri Lankan war that you decided I should put this all in one place?
It was actually an interest in Sri Lanka that came first, which was not it didn't come with the idea of writing a book. In 2009, I was doing an MA in political journalism in Colombia. So I was in New York, and that was the year the war ended in Sri Lanka. And mm-hmm. I was hearing about it, but not hearing enough. And I felt a desperation almost to know more. And I wondered if I was in India, would I have heard more about it? And I spoke to people here, and they weren't hearing much about it either. So it made me think about, so all those 10, those years of whenever I would report on conflict or communal riots or identity in any way made me think about how that would end, and also being in New York and hearing the U.S. war on terror conversations, reading about that, all of it somehow was kind of swirling together in my head because this year was a war on terror, which was how it was defined in Sri Lanka. That mm-hmm. I mean, here was the war on terror that ended, and it was successful, and people were celebrating the end of terrorists and end of civil war. So I wanted mm-hmm. to see what that would be like and whether that was something. And there were world leaders also saying that this could be a model that other countries could replicate. And there were some alarm bells ringing in my head when I heard that, when I read about that, mm-hmm. a model for ending a war, and also because that was the time we were also hearing that thousands of people had died, the 3 million were displaced. So it didn't seem like a model that could be something that could be easily replicated, or if it did, it would cause a lot of, it would be very violent. So I wanted to see anyway. So most of it was questions. And so I went to Sri Lanka. I reported. I just wrote a small piece that I didn't get published because I wrote it for, as a thesis in my master's in Colombia. But that kind of began my questioning and my interest in a way in Sri Lanka much more than interest in terms of as a reporter. And I kept going back, and then it built up. Every time I went there, I only intended to write a couple of pieces or maybe one long piece. And one of those got published later. And it was actually after I published the piece in Caravan that I read some of. That was when I realized that I have already been for so often. By then, I had been there for 3 years. And, I was visiting as much as I could while having a full-time job in New Delhi. And it made me think, what my attachment was to this. Why am I going back? And I still have all these questions. So I talked myself into some more years of commitment to the issue.
It seems like there was a lot of travel involved in terms of reporting the book. I mean, I'm not exactly sure. To what extent you were, for instance, going to the UK to report on some of the sections there, or can you talk a little bit about kind of what you were just saying, in terms of where you living there? Were you spending extended periods to do the research and the writing? Were you writing the book in Sri Lanka, or do you do that after you've done all of your reporting, or?
I used to visit Sri Lanka at least a minimum of twice a year, and each time it would be for a month, because that was how long you get a visa from India. As a, you get a stamp on your papers, and that's 30 days. There was a few times I tried to extend, and I would stay for a little longer. But at every visit it always felt like that would be the last time I visit Sri Lanka. So I would try to do as much as possible in that month. And anytime I was sitting or I slept late and woke up, I would think that that's 2 hours I wasted and I won't get that back. Because I just felt like I may not get another month the next time I come, because I was not following. I was, breaking some visa rules, and I was also traveling to places that I was always conscious that I might not be able to go back to, meeting people who would, after a few days, not pick up my phone calls, and then turn up another year later. So it's the uncertainty was always there, and I was always worried that either I would get into trouble or I would put someone else in harm's way. And so each time I went, I tried to do as much as possible. So this was over 5 years. And the last year I started writing. I didn't do any, apart from the one piece that I wrote, I didn't do other writing. I think most of the writing, if I remember right, that I started towards the end, the first things I did was to write down the history, not even the people's stories. Because I found the history hardest to explain to someone who might not know, and which included me. And I had gone through a process of going from knowing nothing to knowing about the conflict in many different ways, from very different perspectives, propaganda. Everyone had an agenda, and I had, and even academic understanding of the history the history is various. It's not one, conflict history is. So that was the hardest thing for me to write down, and that's what I felt most insecure about. So that's what I kind of started writing about, just as an exercise almost. And then, the people that I'd written about, I had to decide how many people I would write about, what the structure would be like. I thought I would write about 8 people who I had interviewed in depth, but some of those I couldn't corroborate. I didn't feel comfortable. In the end, it was an instinctive decision, but a lot of them, a lot of it had to go through the process of corroboration and some verification. I would visit those. In the last year, I visited many more times, and I would visit the same places that they talked about, look through some more documents, ask them to repeat those stories again, and see, if there were gaps, or of course there were gaps even in the stories of people I wrote about, but whether those gaps could be explained, if there was a reason for those, or whether it was just, if it was lying, whether I could trust them, whether they would trust me enough to let me say the story. So that's kind of towards the end, I was scrambling to decide who I would write about. And then through this process, I decided to write about these three people.
It sounds like a very stressful way to go about the research. If every time you go, you think this may be the last time in your access to people and places and things like that.
Yeah, it was. It was stressful, but it also kind of it puts a fire in your belly. You just don't waste a moment. And I don't. It's like when you have 3 or 4 days to report, and I was used to that in a sense. Except that doing it for 1 month or 3 months is crazy. And there were times it was not. I was annoying people by just. You know, because I have said this to you. Why are you asking me this question again? And I've told you last year. You know, and it shows. My notes are chaotic. And then I had to spend time fixing those things because it was also that there were people who disappeared. From my knowledge, like in terms of they never replied, I couldn't find them in the place. And I was very worried for where they were and what had happened to them. And 1 year later, they would turn up and. As if nothing, you know, those years, that 1 year would have to be filled. So my notes are crazy and all over the place and, but extremely detailed. So at least I had that. I didn't, because I thought I would never see these people again. I would ask them everything that I could. It was also that many questions were not answered. And thankfully, I mean, and this is what I realized in this kind of a long project, that they do get answered in some way because you keep turning up. Someone remembers that question and answers much later, maybe. Yeah, so.
Yep. I'm wondering, in your work, I'm wondering if you could talk about the role of languages in your work. I think we read that you speak at least 4 local languages, including Hindi, Kannada, and Tamil. How did you learn those? Did you learn those out of necessity to improve your reporting, or was it a conscious decision? Did you take classes? How did you come into speaking those languages?
Truthfully, it's all to my parents because I only all of these languages were learned, you know, as a child. Because I was exposed to them and because of movies and music and just having neighbors from these places.
Mm-hmm.
And each one would improve with my living in any of these places that spoke that language. Mm-hmm. Like Tamil was good. But when I lived in Tamil Nadu in India, and then it really changed and improved. Mm-hmm. I learned different dialects, and
right.
In Sri Lanka, I learned a completely different Tamil. Sri Lankan Tamil is quite different, and I had to learn that. The other languages also, like Hindi, it improved a lot when I was in Delhi. It's because of the place I grew up in, which is Bangalore, which is where mm-hmm. I am right now after 10 years. It's a very cosmopolitan city. It has, I also, my family comes from a place that is on the border of 2 states. So we speak a mix of those languages.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I was lucky in that way that it all stuck and it improved. It improved. Now I'm thinking of maybe I want to test myself if I still have the language skills when I learn something completely new, like Spanish or something.
Right. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the role those languages played in your book. I mean, it allowed you to get much deeper, obviously, into a story than, say, somebody who did not speak those languages coming in to report. Did you find that, you know, could you have done your work if you hadn't been able to speak those languages?
When I report in India, I have been to several places where I don't speak the language, like Bengali or, you know, a kind of Hindi that I don't understand. And I've used translators. And mm-hmm. I actually feel like it does require some bit of extra work, but I don't think it's impossible to get a quality that is a consciousness of that translation and of the language barrier. I think helps make a bit more effort, put a little more effort, and it does improve, I think. But in Sri Lanka, the language that Tamil that I had to learn and improve did help mostly to win trust. But the language mm-hmm. and the conversations itself, I think, even if we had translators, it might have been okay. I may be wrong, but this is how I feel. But I will agree that when I was in places where I did not open my mouth and I was being quiet and just observing, it really helped to know the language and just overhear things.
Right, the color, so to speak, would come in to focus for you, for your stories.
Yeah, and it also, people were very different when they actually, the thing I talk say about winning trust, people are very different, and when they find out that you speak the language, not mm-hmm. that it's always inviting or welcoming, it can be very it can be more responsibility if you know the language, and the especially Tamil. When I met people who were happy that I knew Tamil, some of what they wanted from me was an ideological agreement, as if
interesting,
it was because I spoke Tamil, and if I didn't, I might not have. They wouldn't have asked me for that, and then you know we would go through a process where I say that you know I don't, or we would work through that and say that I actually don't feel some of the, especially this because of the kinds of nationalism, the language nationalism that exists in Sri Lanka.
Sure.
It does put me as a person from another country who knows that same language in a position where I have to take sides. Mm-hmm. So I would have to work through that with them and explain to them that, you know, it's not as easy. I do not come from the same experiences. And it is the language we have in common, but very little else.
How did you get around, I know certainly from my work, comes up quite often, you know, when I was working in Afghanistan and you talk to people in Pashto or in any language which isn't English. There would be certain phrases or, you know, the language would have a bring a certain feeling, or certain words would bring a whole kind of cultural context alongside with them. You know, when you're reporting and having these experiences and talking to people almost kind of exclusively in languages which weren't English, did you find difficulties translating that not only kind of literally but kind of contextually back into English, as if, you know, when you wrote out a scene in English, it wouldn't feel the same? Or
that's very true. The context that comes with certain words or phrases was it was more difficult for me to know even until it was some years. And the translation part, you know, I have to, it's just the word they use, and I have to have a paragraph next to that word to explain that context. So I think one of the examples that I have said elsewhere as well, but is that, you know, the word martyr is something that in Tamil is Mahavirar, and they would keep saying that, or they would say Virachava, which is a word which says, you know, kind of a brave death. And they would say that for everybody. And I assume that it meant combatants all the time, but it was for everybody. It was a language that people who lived under militancy for years had adopted. And that was one of the first things that, you know, struck me as something I should understand. But there were many others that it was only after I researched some more that I understood that, you know, there was. And also, you know, words that they would use for defense equipment were almost funny. They were childlike in Tamil. Because they would just describe it. They would, you know, some things that were round, they would call it kind of pellets in Tamil, but it was actually like candy. They would use those words, but it was actually bombs, pieces of bombs. So it was it's just the language, the locality of it also, but also the complete history that they don't even realize that I'm not aware of. So it was interesting, and I was trying not to let that go in translation, but I do think that some of it cannot be captured, you know, even if I, because unless I write a whole, it's one of the things that I wish I had written more about in the book, just ascribing language, giving, you know, the kind of nationalism that is embedded in the language itself. And it's, the very fact some of the words they don't even use several English words that Tamil in India has now adopted shows that there is a need to there is in that choice in that kind of evolution of the language itself there is a story of the identity and a certain kind of preservation of identity.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we could talk briefly about your interview process, if you have one. You know, when you go in as a reporter or doing background research or even primary research for your book, you know, is there a set process that you follow, or you have a routine that you go in? You know, do you develop a short list of hard questions that you want answers to, or is it more you'll go in to get perspective and hear their side of events? Of course, I'm sure it depends on who you're talking to, but do you have any routines about how you interview people, particularly around sensitive or military, you know, information?
Yeah, I do. If I can find information about them through other people or online or in a book, you know, I do as much work as possible. This has become almost a habit, and that I tend to do this now when I meet even people for a drink. It's become a bit nuts, but I do that, you know, because there are not everything can be answered, but it gives me a context about the person. So then I do as much reading up as possible. And I do make some kind of hard questions if I feel like this would be a person, especially for people in authority, in power. I do try to make a list of questions because I'm expecting them to evade things. And I write down questions and how many different ways I can ask that same thing. But when I do meet them, I take it as the moment. I react to the moment, and when I do, a lot of times I think it helps. If it's a person in power, then you know you're usually short. You don't have very much time. That is limited. So then I try to ask as much as possible, and then in the middle somewhere, I think it helps to be quiet. And this I do for everybody. To listen, of course, but also after they've finished answering something, to not say anything. And it's a bit weird and awkward, and I think that helps, and that pushes them to say something. And I don't remember how I developed this, but I started, I think I would, maybe it is something I learned in an oral history class or something like that, where I understood that an awkward moment. It's the only time when in an awkward moment when everybody's quiet, I don't feel the need to fill the silence. I just keep quiet. And I think it has worked many times. It has failed a lot, but it's worth doing, I think. They usually go back to something that they said earlier, or, you know, they ask me a question or something. And that gives me a small glimpse into either their personality or something that's going on in their mind. So that's one thing I do. It's almost like it's habit, and I try it every time. The other is to end the interview and then begin it again.
What do you mean by that? That sounds interesting.
Yeah, you know how it's always at the door that people tell you the most important things, right?
right.
And I know that every journalist knows this, but so I used to wonder what I can do to get them to say things on record. Then you have the trouble of off the record and on the record. So,
sure.
You know, so how do you get them to feel like they're at the door and that I'm on my way out, but to kind of say, so I don't know. I just try every time to
I see.
To sound like I'm done with my questions. I sort of close my book and I try it. And then I still ask them something else, like, what are you working on? You know, the kind of loose questions that you can throw out there. And that is still an interview because I'm still on record. We haven't gotten up. I mostly write notes and don't record unless it's, you know, the kind of person who would allow me to record, like, again, like politicians or someone. They'd be fine with it, but many others who still are cagey about being interviewed and would not allow me to switch on dictaphone. Like in Sri Lanka, people wouldn't allow me to switch on the dictaphone, the red light or the, anything blinking around them. They would really be paranoid about that. They would really worry, and they could mm-hmm. not focus on anything. And that kind of would undo all the comfort. I mean, all the work that you put in making somebody feel comfortable. So I didn't take out my dictaphone. Mm-hmm. But I would still be writing notes, but ask these questions that seem that are important to me, which they don't feel are interview questions. You know, people mm-hmm. think that they all have to have a point, but I like to know kind of, you know, how, what do you have in the rest, what do you have to do the rest of the day, or, you know, what are you working on? Mm-hmm. How many people work with you? You know, where are you actually from? Who,
right.
What the other kind of questions which give me a fuller idea of this person, and they feel like this is just chit chat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Speaking of talking to authority, I'm wondering if you had ever had any problems with state intimidation. Essentially, the piece that you read out the section from is actually doesn't have your name on it. It's written by anonymous. What kind of problems did you or did you face problems researching and telling these stories from Sri Lanka?
I guess the way intimidation works, I realized, was by putting as many obstacles in your way as possible. And very rarely and much later do they actually intervene and do anything. Most of it is preventing you from doing things. Mm-hmm. And that is the difficulty to work around, because you wonder what the consequences will be. And they're just sort of waiting for you to break the rules so that then they can move in. A lot of times I wrote the piece anonymously because I was sure, I was very worried that if I wrote about these people, somehow they could be traced. I didn't feel I did change some information and change the name, but I still worried that identifying markers would remain in the piece. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, somehow I tried to hide there by hiding my identity. I mm-hmm. tried to protect them in some way, but also to allow me to go back. So as a foreign journalist, the greatest worry for me and the way the government can control me is through the visa. Mm-hmm. First of all, so that was always on top of my mind. And we had a discussion with the editor of Caravan, and we did thought about it, you know, whether it's worth it, whether I'm being paranoid. But I decided to err on the side of caution and sort of just be careful, just to be able to go back. And the other is to even when you're allowed in, like, you know, I can allow in, I get a visa, I go in. There are parts of the country that I cannot visit, which are closed off to foreigners or closed off to journalist activists. Mm-hmm. And this was the case from 2009 to 2011. After that, it was less difficult, but still, you know, there would be surveillance and all of that. So you put your information out there and you're trying to get permission to in each of these places. And I would still, you know, try to work around those. Like, for example, when I was traveling to the north, this was in 2009, this is the very first time, I wasn't allowed to take the road there because the highway was bombed and there were refugees living all over. And it was where you could see the war zone. This is after the end of the war, and people were still not allowed to travel by road. And you could go there so I had to get permission from the Ministry of Defense separately to go there. But they gave me a letter in which they said I can fly. It said, you know, the sentence was to go to Jaffna and fly back. So I took the letter and I took a taxi and I went. And, you know, some unthinking behavior is, you know, the kind of risk taking. It's because of not thinking too much about it. So I just did it anyway and took the road, and I was stopped at the checkpoint, and they asked me for my letter, and I gave them the letter, and they said first of all, like, four guys could not read English, four of the army, four soldiers, and then they called the, you know, so it was, you know, none of this I knew would happen, you know. I expected him right. to be able to read it, and the situation just unfurls and you react to it. And when the senior was finally called and he looked at the paper, he said, "It says you should fly there. Why are you taking the road?" And then I kind of looked at the letter and I told him, "It just says that I should fly back. I thought I could go take the road there." You know, and I don't know how I thought of it, but I just said that. It was on the spur of the moment. And he seemed confused and they didn't know what to do. They searched the car, kept us there for half an hour, but finally let me go and allowed me to travel there. So it was just random. I could have been sent back, you know, as easily. So it was that. Those moments are the ones you're always keeping in your mind. This you're kind of preparing for it, and also you can't fully prepare for it at all because it is random, it's arbitrary, it's the person there at the checkpoint. There is no rule. It's sure, always sure. You. They're waiting for you to break the rule, and like then they'll come and do something. So it just that I prepared as much as possible to not get people into trouble and everything, but. Most of the time, it was just something that I react to, and after taking the risk.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before we started the recording, in terms of kind of when you were working on the book, which I guess, as you said, kind of came towards the end of the process, that you developed a kind of morning routine or kind of a set of things that you were doing in terms of getting writing done. Could you maybe kind of explain that and describe a bit what you were doing in that respect?
I guess most of my writing would get actually done in the day, in the morning. And I did not have the kind of routine that I developed while I was writing the book. Earlier as a journalist, I only reacted to deadlines and, you know, I would sit for 3 days straight and just write. But because this is a longer deadline, and I started it even before I had, a deadline with a publisher, it was something that I was doing by myself. And so the way I did it was just to, there was no more routine as such, but I would make sure that when I wake up in the morning, I would turn off the Wi-Fi first and try and read something. I noticed that if I sat at the computer or if I did something else, you know, talk to someone else or watch TV or something, it would kill the kind of calm with which I wake up. And I would usually just read something if it was either related to the book or not or whatever, not a newspaper, but something like, you know, even fiction. And that helped put me in a certain place where I felt I was already engaging with words and that I wanted to write after that. And I had a way to once I started understanding that a day that is gone, you know, because I was lazy or someone came home or I spent too long at lunch. If the day was gone, it's gone. I was not going to waste the next day. And this was something that helped me that if I wrote 1,000 words today, I wrote it. If I didn't, I'm not going to try and write 2,000 words tomorrow. I should just still write, 1,000 words. That put less pressure on me. So, you know, it's kind of mind games that you play with yourself. So it was important for me to come to my desk. Also, many times I just went away from the routines that my home required or, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of what I now feel is pleasure, but then was pressure from social pressure, sort of. Yeah. You want to meet people or just do things. Sure. You tell yourself you deserve a break. None of that was there when I just went away to a place where there would be no network, and I found many of those places. Some very generous people have allowed me to stay with them. 10 days, and in 10 days I would do much more than I would in 10 days when I'm home. Mm-hmm. I would just go off somewhere and just get work done because I have nothing else to do but just do that. So even if I was not writing, I would read. So this has actually made me realize that made me more disciplined than I was before I wrote the book. And I try to do that now as a freelance journalist. I don't have something to write every day, but I just try to read in the morning. So it makes me feel like my brain's already, it's the way it just kicks in. You know, you have your coffee and you read something and it starts. So by evening, at least I have a real excuse to take a break and I'm not panicking at the time.
You mentioned in the acknowledgement section, you said that Dave Swan in Chichester had given you a trick for finishing a first draft. What did you mean by that? What is the trick?
Oh, give it away that easily? No, I mean, it's nothing. It's just actually because it's this massive project. It's like a mountain that I'm like looking to climb, and it felt really overwhelming. He said to think of it, because he's a poet, mm-hmm. and he said to think of it as either verses, or he actually told me like 10 ways. One of them stuck in my head. He also said that I should think of it. You know, I forget who does this. Is it John McPhee who draws a diagram of the structure?
And
Dave told me that someone he knew thought of that structure, drew it, and made it into a pendant and wore it around his neck. That sounded like punishment. So that was one of the things he said. But what I really adopted was thinking of the book as a collection of scenes. So, and that stuck with me because what I find easiest to write and what I really felt sure about was the scenes that I was writing. It may have things that I have to corroborate and things that I have to work on in terms of language and dialogue, and be sure of things that people said. But those were still things that I already knew. I didn't have to imagine them. I didn't have to do any extra work than what was on my notes. I just had to present those stories that have already been told to me in the best and most complex and still the truest way possible. So I thought of that. And then when I went from one scene to another, and it was also going to be chronological because I wanted to show uncertainty, the uncertainty that I felt, that people felt, that existed in life in the aftermath of war. I wanted to show that. So it was going to be chronological. So I just had to say, go from scene to scene. And of course, choose scenes. There are the big scenes that pop, that I already knew were going to be part of it. And then the others that would add layers. So when I went from scene to scene, I knew what I had to fill in, what gaps were there. It helped me because I also usually write from beginning to end, and then I can move things around. So this was a really good suggestion from Dave that it also made me, when I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking what I'm going to write today, I know two scenes that I'm going to write. Whether I write them or not, that is my goal for the day.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also quantifying it in some way.
How did you kind of manage the structure? I mean, I found it extremely interesting how you jump between the different characters, and it felt very seamless, but I can certainly imagine, or maybe it wasn't, but I can imagine while you were writing, there would have been a lot of kind of questions and thoughts as to which scenes go where, and how do you, was it a question of kind of diagramming out or kind of charting out with cards the entire structure of the whole book up front, or were you doing this as you go along, or were you using kind of some kind of tools on your laptop to manage that?
I was writing on Scrivener, but I didn't have I used those cards that they have there, the cork board, but you know, that it was almost that I was putting on my laptop what I had already done with my hand on paper. I did a sort of, I don't know, I'm still not, I can still write and I can't write anymore on paper, you know, paper and pen. But it's still a kind of planning and, you know, the tortured writing, mm-hmm. I can only sort of do in paper. And so, sort of like making notes of the structure. I did a flow chart. It changed almost every day at some points and changed every week at others. And I tried to intertwine it with, you know, the history, what each moment in somebody's life would allow me to say apart from just the scene. Some of the big decisions that I had to make were, I kept changing till the end when I just decided to stick with something. Because any way could have been right, I guess. I couldn't decide after a point. So I just stuck with what I had decided. Was things like, at what point do I start giving, when do I give the background for these people? Like one of the characters who has had, one of the characters is a mother. She's middle-aged, and I had to go back this, I'm writing the story in 2008, and I had to go back to 1983 to tell something that I felt was important and would add context to what I would write in the next chapter. So I kept moving that part around. I didn't know whether it should be. And finally, it makes it in, I think, the second or the third chapter. And for me, that was... I kept moving that around. And that, like, in on Scrivener, that moved a lot of places. And then I started making copies, and it felt in many different locations. And then finally, when it felt right in this place, because that was a point at which I felt someone would care for her, would give, she would become a real person with the back, with a history, and not just this, just a mother who was looking for her son. She, it would be someone who had had life experiences. So I decided to put it right there. Another another section was about when to reveal a certain thing that about one of the characters that I felt would feel, where would it feel like a betrayal, and when would it be too soon to reveal something. It was also because I was not sure what I felt. So each time I had some structural problem, I knew that it was actually a problem about, I was just figuring out, it was not about where how I should write it, but about what I think about this particular thing. Since, do I trust this person? Do I have to write this? Do I hide it? And if it, so then, you know, that was actually the structural problem. And it helped to move things around on Scrivener. And in the end, I did make some big changes. The editor also, when he read some of the preface, we locked a huge section off. And I think that was a good decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're talking a lot here about structure. I'm wondering, and you also just mentioned, you know, several... tips or tricks and also tools. Definitely not our first guest to talk about Scrivener and the Cogboard, yeah. And laying it all out. Would you say that was the most useful or essential tool in your writing, you know, in your arsenal of weapons, or what was like the single most useful tool for creating the structure for your book for you?
In the software?
Or just anything, whether it's taking notes or using the flowcharts you mentioned, or mapping out each chapter with note cards, or was it using Scrivener?
I think the flowcharts on paper were most useful. Scrivener was good to have in the end because it doesn't mess with what I have written before. So I don't have the panic of losing something and not being able to go back to what I originally thought. So that was the most useful thing. And also I could see it, and I had, you know, I had color-coded it and all of that, and given myself a sense of being organized. In the end, it was actually those flowcharts that I'd written on paper, you know, on long empty sheets, sort of long plain sheets, and written them down and laid them all around me till I felt I was drowning in them. And that's what actually, yeah. I think there's a way in which you can surround, I usually surround myself with chaos, and then it actually forces me to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots and lots of people kind of mentioned in the acknowledgement section of the book, and I know from my own experience working on books that this is so often the case. You know, you have the author obviously on the front cover, but there are all sorts of kind of people who read drafts, offer comments, work on the text, whether from the publisher or agents or whatever. I'm kind of interested in the editing process for the book. What did this look like? Was it long and drawn out? Was it painless? Did you enjoy it?
I actually enjoyed it, though it was quite painful. It was at some point it was me who had to make the decision. I had sent the draft out to. Even while the publisher's editor was looking at it, I'd sent the draft out to Sugi, who I mentioned in the acknowledgement. She's a fiction writer, and she's also a writer teaching. She teaches writing. There was another person who I used to sit and write with. She's sort of my writing partner in Bangalore. She's a lay person reading it. And there were some other academics who I sent it to. So this was, I guess, three ways in which I was looking at it. And I mean, two of them were Sri Lankan and one was not. So when they gave their feedback, they were all opposing each other, the feedback. So I had to figure out, you know, and they were, there was a, my writing partner was wonderful. She sent even smileys and thumbs ups and there were parts where she would say, I'm feeling confused. You know, so it was real. That was very real feedback for me. You know, things I could do something with. What?
It sounds like kind criticism. I've certainly had people who've kind of, you know, written in the margins, you know, this is bullshit. And
yeah. So the other guys, the other people were did that. And, you know, so it's but all of them were very constructive. And I think I give myself credit in choosing these people because I knew that they would give me constructive criticism. Nobody just ran the text down. All of them told me what exactly was problematic. Of course, the way in which I fix it is up to me. And there were a lot of suggestions. And finally, this all happened in 2 months, and that's the turnaround time was very little. So I changed myself a lot, and then the editor, the publisher, came up with, you know, smaller kind of structural changes than I had myself already made. So all of this was happening over 2 months after the draft. I don't think the text had to be changed much. They definitely helped me really tighten it and made me realize a lot of things that about my own language that, you know, I studied UK English, British English, but I consume all kinds of English, you know, and I also speak a sort of Indian English. And when I wrote, it was a mix of everything. So I think the wonderful thing that the Verso editor, Mark, was able to do was to, he's British, who lives in New York and, you know, has read a lot of South Asian writing. So he was able to identify what and give a certain kind of continuity to the language, but never undoing, just making me conscious of at which point I was being South Asian, at which point I was being British, at which point I was being American. And that was, and finally leaving the decision to me. So that was wonderful to know that about that language. And that was something that I think helped, you know, tightening and also helped it not jar someone reading. So all the feedback, I think, was something that I am really, really thankful for. But I didn't send it out to 10 people, and I'm glad I didn't, because even with three, you know, kinds of feedback, so, you know, one gives me about writing and continuity and structure, which Sugi did. Then there was Matangi, who was my writing partner, who gave me an idea of what it feels like to read the book and at what points you know, that is actually structural feedback for me. At what point she feels she didn't know enough and when she wanted more. Then there was the third kind of feedback, which is several different academics, and I think of them as one person, because they were all giving me the places, pointing out places that they needed nuance, pointing out places where I was making judgment without base, without having enough, you know, without giving enough of an argument. So that is the, you know, the politics of it. Mm-hmm. So I felt that once I could reconcile all of them, it helped. I did feel like I should have done more, but I guess that's...
You always feel that, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it reads extremely... I came at the book with very little sense of what it was going to be, and one of our kind of future podcast guests, in fact, recommended it to me. And there were... and I came at it also knowing relatively little about Sri Lanka and the history there. The way you've written it, if someone would have told me at the end, you know, this is fiction, none of it actually happened, it's a novel, I could also imagine that a world in which that was true. I don't mean that to say that clearly everything is made up. I just mean to say you must have taken a decision, or it seems like you took a decision early on when you were writing about the type of voice you were going to use in a book. I happen to think that fiction is actually often a really good way to tell truths about situations which you can't in nonfiction. I was wondering, you know, it can go wrong as well. You can misrepresent characters' thoughts, perhaps. I don't know, there are all sorts of kind of issues around it. How did you, what was your thought process in deciding to write the book this way, or is that just your style? Or
The style, I had to figure out what style I had, because it's my first book. I made a decision early on to write about Sri Lanka and through human stories. And after I made the decision to write just about three people, it gave me room to say more about them than just a sequence of unfortunate events. And it helped that. And how do I get to know somebody more fully than, you know, a narrative of their trauma was to tell, to kind of get into their regular lives and their ordinary thoughts and decisions and motivations. And when I was thinking of these things, it was only because I wanted people to care about this. That was the main motivation of even writing the book, because I cared and I wanted other people to care when they read the book. And it's only when we really know someone, I think our biases can maybe, when we care about someone, we know someone, our biases can be diluted, or we can at least fight them a little bit. So all of this, I felt, is what I usually felt when I read fiction about, which was set in a place that, you know, I didn't know about, or that was set in a complex situation. And even Sri Lanka, most of the books that most moved me that I had read, you know, before as a regular reader, not thinking about reporting on Sri Lanka, they were fiction. And the nonfiction that I read was very dry. There were some amazing facts out there, and there was storytelling, but there was immediately the need to fortify that storytelling with the serious voice of a reporter, which was serious in the sense that it was dry and it was textbook like, and I was wondering how I can make all of this come together, the storytelling, the fullness of a person, the context, the complexity of the context, and all the gray zones that fiction seems to have monopoly on almost. And I felt that maybe this could be done in nonfiction. And I wondered how it would be if you cared about someone and you were reading all of these events, and it was, the kind of thing that you were reading it through the night. And suddenly you remembered, or you realized that, okay, this is nonfiction. This really happened to this person. I wondered what that would feel like. It was an experiment that I gave myself. And there are issues of, while writing it, there were issues of, whether I was whether it was fancy language or whether I was describing something, because it was really, there were points at which I constantly was doubting myself and my interpretation of a scene or a feeling or a decision that someone made. I thought of it actually kind of like a song where you, this is another something that some professor just randomly said and it stuck in my head, that you care, you, in the end, you're just left with a feeling, but there are so many parts to it, that there is the part where you just lose yourself, there's instrumentation, and there are parts where suddenly you hear the lyrics and you wonder what this song is about, where this came from. And I kind of started thinking of it like that, whenever I felt confused. And I knew at every time that I did have all of this work that I'd put in, and I did have the strong basis of a complex history that I was trying to write, that I would keep correcting. And I had these very real people who had spent this much time with me and said so many things, taking a lot of risk. So that sense of responsibility, finally, that was, if I had to say one thing that made me write it as nonfiction, it was a sense of responsibility, because it was something they asked from me. Everyone who told their story to me said it with a sense of them saying that they were not unique. That's not what I felt. They kept saying that they were not unique, and this was some just one of many stories. And if I could make people read their stories and still, you know, that kind of the nonfiction part is so that no one ever feels that it's just a story, but that it happened and there are more people out there who have experienced these things, and not just in Sri Lanka, but in so many other places.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a minute or two ago, you know, that this was the first book, so it was a lot of learning, and you came into the tone and the structure and the style of the book, you know, on your own, and figured it out as you went with this idea of telling people's stories. Were there any authors or journalists who had written anything that inspired you or served as a model for the book, either style-wise or structure-wise, that you leaned on or really admired and influenced you in any way?
Yeah, the writing about the three people was something that, you know, already three is a magical number in writing structure, right? So that was anyway a given. But there was one of the first books that I read that were written in this way was Common Ground by Anthony Lucas about busing in Boston. And that was, he gets into a lot of detail. It is so strong, and you care about these people, about these three families. So that was one of the books. The other was actually Half of a Yellow Sun by Adichie. And that is what made me feel. Around that time, when I was reading this book, this is stuff I was reading. Common Ground I'd read before, and I was rereading it. But at some point, I was reading Half of Yellow Sun, and it was during my writing. And I felt that when I felt confused about why I'm writing about these people, reading her and her questioning, there was a little interview at the back of the book where she talked about emotional truth. And where, you know, that is what makes fiction believable. So I kind of inverted it in my head. You know, a factual truth is there for fiction, but perhaps emotional truth could make nonfiction more believable as well. That's sure. Give me license to write about their thoughts and about their love affairs and, you know, movies they liked and all of that. So that was another book. Then, you know, there's all the other. One of the decisions also I had to make was to not include myself in the story as an I. I mean, I am there with my perception and my you know, analysis, but I didn't want to have the I. It was something that I felt kind of. It was instinctive. It was an organic decision. But when Catherine Boo's book came out. And there were so many interviews in which she was asked why didn't you include yourself? I mean, she wrote a whole book trying not to include herself, and all the interviews focused on that as well. So it was interesting why she didn't do it, and I felt in those it validated my decision almost, and I felt more confident that it was fine and that I could still. I could still be personally there, and if I couldn't justify myself as a character, then I shouldn't be in it. That was what I thought. And then when I saw, you know, her explanations, that helped me as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these were some of the books, of course, but mostly sure. It was just I tried to read as many non-American and non-British books as possible. I mean, books that were set outside of these places.
Mm-hmm. I want to be respectful of your time, but just before we get to the picks of the week, I was just wondering what are you up to these days? What are your kind of future writing plans? Any books or things that we can look out for in the future?
I'm going back to being a hack, a freelance one, and just doing, you know, a different topic every day. The reason why I became a journalist. Throw myself in more unfamiliar situations and just, you know, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm based now in India, but I would like to write about South Asia. And let's see if freelance financially works, if it works creatively. I always have had a job, so I want to give this a shot now. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know about book projects. I don't think I'm thinking about that at all. If this has happened organically, and that's why I could be committed to it, because I think if I had made a decision, I would have lost interest in some way. If I made a decision early on, that's what I feel. I think something has to become an obsession. And if it does, if I realize it, maybe I'll do another book.
So coming to the kind of picks, do you have a book you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, there's this book called Traitor by a Tamil writer called Shobha Shakti. He lives in France now. And it's about a bumbling terrorist. And I love the playfulness of the book. It's very real issues. It's translated. And I always admire those who can write about a serious situation with not just darkness, but a kind of wit. I think Shobha Shakti does it in Traitor. I want to say one more book, which is Mohammad Hanif's A Case of Exploding Mangoes, which also, for the same reasons, it's witty and it's racy, and it's it plays with, takes a real situation and plays with it in fiction. So I quite like that. So that's the book, those two books. And what is the other one you wanted? Film.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a document. It's a documentary film called Katia Baz, which is based in India. It's about a town called Kanpur, and it's a fascinating story of this man who is an electrician who specializes in illegal connections. The documentary is about his war with the electricity board head, a woman, and it, through this they tell us the wars of the haves and have-nots, and those who have electricity and those who don't, you know. So he's sort of Robin Hood character, but I loved the documentary. It's fascinating, and it's out there with subtitles and everything. So that's the film.
A song?
Song.
I couldn't think of a song, you know. I really tried. So I'll tell the name of a person who... So I listen to a lot of Sufi, and this is Sanam Marvi. And if I had to say one song, it would be Itnaheen. She's done that for this kind of production, this show called Coke Studio, which Pakistan has and India has. I thought I should suggest things that people might not have heard of and located in South Asia. So I would say many other things, but since you limited me to one each, this is what it is.
Fantastic. That actually does it for our interview. Rohini, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. It was great.
For our listeners, the notes to this show and much more can be found at our website, sourcesandmethods.com. Thanks for listening.